And you're listening to Radio Regent, and this is a Saturday Morning Live. We now go to Amandla over at CHRY 105.5 FM, which Amandla, an African perspective, plays every Sunday, noon to one, on CHRY.
I am with my special guest today, Daniel, who is from Vancouver. He's based in Vancouver right now, to discuss about an issue that he addressed in one of his articles regarding the relationship between climate change and migration. Can you hear me, Daniel?
Hello? Yes, I can hear you now.
I guess I will start by just asking you to give us a little brief highlight of the article you wrote regarding migration and climate change.
Mm-hmm. So it's an article that's currently out right now in the current issue of the Georgia Strait, which is a Vancouver alternative news weekly. And so what I looked at in that article is the social effect of climate change. The reality is that climate change is already affecting people in the global south, whether it's South Asia, Southeast Asia, Africa, South America, and various places also in the north, by primarily through displacement. Climate change, some of the effects of climate change are things like rising sea levels, affecting the production of crops, deforestation, desertification, more disasters like typhoons and hurricanes and such, and the kind of it affects rainfall and things like that, and all of these things taken together are affecting the way people live, especially people who typically are closer to the land than we might be here. And so people are on the move. People have been migrating for years now. Usually they migrate within regions, so they are internally displaced, but sometimes they will attempt to move to different countries and even different continents. And the discussion the last few years is about how rapid climate change and dramatic climate change, which is in the foreseeable future, in the near future, how that might affect climate, or how that might affect migration, how many people will migrate in the next few years, in the next few decades. Some are saying tens of millions of people. Some are even saying up to a billion people will be displaced and will be migrating due either directly or indirectly to climate change. So that was kind of the essential point. I also discussed in the article the fact that, unfortunately, most Western countries aren't dealing with this issue in the way they should be. The best way to deal with this would be to have open borders, to be accessible and accepting of migrants, people who are displaced because of our measures. But instead, of course, Canada, for instance, has moved towards emphasizing temporary foreign worker programs, where we bring people in for short terms and pay them wages lower than other workers, and then they're kicked out, and then they don't have a chance to actually settle and immigrate to Canada. And we've also, most troublingly, recently shifted towards indefinite detention of migrants, people who are waiting to hear whether they're going to get to stay, whether their refugee application is going to be accepted or approved, are instead of us processing that quickly and being accepting, we are detaining them, usually in or often in maximum security prisons, There are about 10,000 people who have been detained at some point in Canada just in the last year, a few hundred of which have been detained for more than 90 days, some of which have been detained for years, and they've committed no crimes. So this is where Canada's been headed. And what I was trying to get at in this article was, in light of the fact that there will be more migrants in the next few years, what does the fact about how we are currently treating migrants say about how we might treat migrants later? And my tentative answer is that it's not looking too good. It's not looking like we're going to treat migrants really well.
Now we have noticed that in lots of northern countries, this issue of migration and immigrants, especially in Europe and to a lesser extent here in Canada, is always centered during the political competition when there is elections. How that whole phenomenon is impacting the political debate here in Canada and also in European countries, where we have noticed recently lots of waves of racism related to the question of migration, etc.
Mm-hmm. Well, within Canada, so far, climate migration specifically hasn't been discussed too much. But one very good example was, I also mentioned this in the article, there were 492 Tamil refugees or asylum seekers who reached the shores of British Columbia back in 2010. And they were all immediately put into detention. Into various detention centers throughout British Columbia. And what happened was Stephen Harper and other politicians used that phenomenon, used this instance of migrants reaching the shores of British Columbia to stir up a certain sentiment, stir up a certain conception of migrants as being people who are key jumpers or who are trying to take advantage of Canada's goodwill or are, you know, trying to go through unfair means through the immigration process rather than going through the proper refugee system or immigration process. They're trying to jump ahead in some way. And so he really did it was pretty successful job of vilifying those particular migrants. And in doing that, they were able to pass certain laws, anti-smuggling legislation specifically, which played a role in developing the current trend of detaining migrants indefinitely. So I'm not sure about specifically during election times, but yes, there are politicians who insincerely use or capitalize on certain anti-migrant sentiment in order to pass legislation which serves their interests.
Mm-hmm. Now, regarding the more specifically the question of African immigrants, we have noticed recently lots of issues in the Middle East, in Egypt, in Israel, and in Saudi Arabia. The treatment that African immigrants have been going through as a result of them being in those countries. In your research, have you come up with any idea of how the proportion of people who in those situations have been migrating as a result of climate change or as a result of other factors?
Right, right. That's a very good question. That's actually something that's very difficult to say. The climate change issue is actually one that should be situated within a bigger discussion about capitalism, dispossession, through things like multinational land grabs and various measures that are fundamentally economic and political. Trying to directly connect one person's reason for migrating to climate change is very difficult. So it's hard to say, but often there is a way of looking at, as I said, as embedding climate change within this bigger discussion. And what you can often see is that climate change does play some role in the larger process. So, for instance, perhaps in a region there might be, because of climate change, there might be less food growing. And as a result, food prices might rise. And then that in turn might lead to social or political upheaval, which then motivates somebody to migrate elsewhere. But it's really hard to say the proportion of these migrants in the Middle East or in Israel who are directly motivated by climate disruption.
Mm-hmm. It's interesting that you mentioned the question of the larger picture of capitalism, how it impacts this movement of people across the world. The question in the case of Africa, of course, we can talk about the processes of land grabs happening that are pushing people off their lands and agriculture dying a little bit and making people to move around to find a better living condition elsewhere. Some countries like China and India recently developing countries are saying that they are entitled to go through the same process of consumption and development that have an impact in terms of climate change, and that they are not really very favorable to measures limiting the impact of climate change. What's your analysis on that regarding to the other Western countries who we know are one of the major players in terms of disturbing the climate change?
So, sorry, you're asking, there are these countries who won't admit their involvement in climate disruption?
Yes, they're saying that they cannot take some measures like limiting some production of that are impacting the climate change because they have some developmental needs that makes them, you know, be in a position to go through the same path, basically, as the Western countries. And they are reluctant to adopt some measures like limiting the gas emission and those kind of stuff. And I was just wondering if you have any analysis of what are the major players right now who are impacting the climate change and what can be done in the future to limit that impact.
Right. Yeah, well, there's a global capitalist system which has swept up practically every state or just everybody. And once you're immersed in that system, it's very hard for states, even states who weren't originally within the core Western capitalist system, to extricate themselves and to mitigate climate change and reduce their production. There are some states who are coming up with justifications for why they can't do that. What can be done? That's the crucial question at this point. There needs to be dramatic mitigation, because at this point the changes are already underway. The number of tipping points that have already been triggered is enough to put us on the path, even if we didn't emit any carbon dioxide from now on, it would continue to put us on a path that would just devastate people all around the world, particularly in the Global South and Africa. So, I mean, at this point, I really don't know. I don't know what can be done. Dramatic mitigation is, of course, necessary. But as I said, because we're already down this path, we need to adapt. We need to recognize that there will be migrants, and we need to be more inclusive of these people who are going to be moving, who are being displaced and dispossessed because of our actions.
And now, how was your article received by the public, the wider public? Because I read some of the comments of people on one of the websites when the article was published, and some people are saying, oh, well, some of these issues raised are not really related to climate change, but they are, like, say, the tsunami is not really climate change, but it's some more, I don't know how they describe it, but they're challenging the idea that some of these phenomenon are not really related to climate change. How was the article received by, what's the feedback that you get, and what do you have to answer to those people challenging that idea that climate change is playing a role in terms of displacing people right now across the globe?
Right. Yeah, that's a really common response. I mentioned, or I started the article with a story about a tsunami which took place almost exactly 25 years ago in Bangladesh, and the point of that story was that it connects with salt saturation in the land, and that coupled with rising sea levels triggers, and rising sea levels of course is connected to climate change, so the two, rising sea levels and salt saturation, trigger a certain effect, negative effect on crop production in Bangladesh. But of course, people will see tsunami, just any mention of tsunami, and say, well, hey, tsunamis aren't caused by climate change. And, well, you know, so there are people like that. A few of the comments, which were more common and more troubling, I think, to the article, were people saying we shouldn't do anything to be more inclusive of these climate refugees. There were people who were essentially calling for the exact thing which I was trying to highlight and warn about in the article, which is this gradual trend towards us being more anti-migrant, more authoritarian, and more closed off to people who we should be more inclusive to. So that's really troubling. Canada, the Canadian public and the Canadian political system really needs to change its mindset on that issue, because you know, this is the time to really build the infrastructure so that we're more inclusive of migrants and inclusive of them in such a way that they can actually immigrate and enjoy all the benefits and rights that all of us enjoy, rather than being used as cheap labor or being forced into the indefinite detention process.
Now, some people would argue that in the case of Africa, that that is very concerning for us, is that the African countries also have a responsibility in terms of creating the conditions to maintain the population in their countries, and then creating the conditions for them to have decent survival conditions. Yeah. And most of the time when there are some debate or some negotiation at the international level, the African countries' voice is not very heard very loudly. Any suggestion or any feeling of what can be done politically at the African level to make sure that the voice of Africa and the global South will have will be heard really in those international scene?
Right. I don't know. I don't know how. You kind of asked two questions. The first question, there are many things African governments can do to create conditions that are more that are better for Africans. One biggest issue, which is connected to climate change, is the issue of multinationals grabbing land within Africa, just large tracts of land. One of the motivations for multinationals to do that is one of many motivations is climate change, because of climate change and increasing food prices and reduced stock of food, they have a certain incentive to buy up land elsewhere, of course, right? Cheap land. And they're doing that in Africa. And governments, African governments, are facilitating that land grab process. And there are many governments who are getting paid to sell off land that is rightfully the people's. And in the process of dispossessing these people, they are giving nothing back in compensation, or very little back, or in compensation. So, you know, that's a major thing. That's an important process that's deeply connected to climate change, and has pretty much the same effect of climate change, that people are being forced to migrate, are being dispossessed, are unable to provide for themselves because of this process. In this case, it's an economic process. So that needs to be addressed. This is one of many things, of course, African governments can do. But as for the second question about what African states can do in order to amplify the concerns of Africa in the face of climate change on the international scene, I'm not sure. To be honest, I'm not even sure if the international scene is even the way to go. The international community doesn't really seem to care about the global south. You know, the international community facilitates the empowerment of those who are currently in power. So, I mean, is it concerned with the global south? Is it concerned with Africa? Is it really concerned with the manifestations of climate change in Africa? I don't think so.
Absolutely, absolutely right. Maybe we seem to be running short of out of time, and maybe you can just indicate people where they can find a complete article if they would like to go a little bit deeper into your analysis.
Right. It might be more difficult to do that. I would say go to it's www.strait.com. That's the website for the Georgia Strait. And from there, you can search, is Canada prepared for climate refugees?
I would like to thank you very much for being with us and for your insight regarding this question. And I'm sure the discussion will continue in the days or months to come. Thank you for being with us today, Daniel.
Thank you. It's my pleasure.
You are listening to Amanla, an African Perspective on CHRY 105.5 in Toronto. And in this last segment of the show, I'm with my special guest, Thomas Panaya. I hope I pronounce it properly.
Perfect.
To discuss with him on the legacy of Nelson Mandela and his recollection of the activities surrounding the anti-apartheid struggle here in Toronto and Canada in general. Thomas Panaya is a PhD and was a lecturer on social studies, assistant director of studies, and faculty associate on the project of on justice, welfare, and economics at Harvard University from 2003 to 2011. He taught courses on modern social and political thought, the philosophy and method of the social sciences, globalization and global justice. He is currently an affiliate of Harvard's David Rockefeller Center for Latin American Studies, and his Rabble column offers commentary on contemporary social, political, and cultural ideas, issues, and events. Can you hear me, Daniel? Thanks for being with us today.
And
as a person who have been most likely involved here in the anti-apartheid struggle, with the passing of Nelson Mandela, there have been a lot of tributes going on across the world. What was your recollection of how the anti-apartheid struggle was happening here in Canada, and how, what was the role that was played by people to achieve some of the small gains that were made up there?
Well, I was active in the anti-apartheid struggle in Montreal, and it was a very exciting period. It was my first political activism,
And what was nice about that activism is it linked us up to a number of other types of activism. Solidarity with Cuba, solidarity with indigenous people, anti-racist politics here in Canada and in the U.S. It was a great movement for its because of its capacity to build links to other movements. And I think we played a very important role. What people today seem to forget was that when Mandela was arrested in the early 60s, he was arrested as a terrorist. But when he came out, the social movements had created such a positive image of him that when he came out, he was treated as a hero. And I think that shows the impact of political activists. We can create an atmosphere, a context, which can completely transform the reception of a figure.
Now, what would you think would be the legacy of the struggle and then the legacy of the person who just passed away, Nelson Mandela? Because I guess some of the issues that were on the table when people were fighting against apartheid are still on the table today. What's your analysis of what will be learned as a major lessons from Mandela's involvement in the anti-apartheid struggle?
Well, there are a number of things, I think. I mean, first of all, in terms of his legacy is politically and economically, it's an ambiguous legacy. Personally, individually, it's of course a grand, remarkable legacy. But as a political figure, I think it's an ambiguous legacy. There are many. For example, today South Africa has a very high unemployment rate, around 40%. It has a very high poverty rate. It has a very high rate of inequality. And it's interesting to compare Mandela to President Chavez of Venezuela. You remember when Chavez came to power in 1998 in Venezuela, Venezuela had a 50% poverty rate. 12 years later, in 2010, Venezuela's poverty rate had dropped to 24%. Under the policies of the Chavez government, Venezuela cut poverty in half. And that's because Chavez challenged neoliberalism. Now, Mandela, of course, came to power in the early 90s in South Africa. And it was a time when neoliberal globalization was at its most powerful. And in that sense, Mandela was very influenced by the context. And so he didn't make the kind of progressive political and economic, progressive economic policies that others in Latin America have done since and continue to do today. I mean, for example, the leaders in Bolivia and Ecuador and Argentina, etc., as well as Venezuela. So in that sense, Mandela's legacy is ambiguous. Now, there are many positive things he did do, of course. He prevented a civil war in South Africa. We can't underestimate that. He established a non-racial legal structure. He disabled the far-right white population in South Africa. He established a democratic president by staying for only one term. I think these are great achievements. But, of course, it's ambiguous because we still have high unemployment, high poverty, high rate of inequality.
Right. And it's absolutely true. And you mentioned that that was your involvement within the anti-apartheid struggle was one of your first learning tools in terms of global activism. And what would you say to current generation, younger generation of Africans or students who even didn't know, are not aware of the impact they can make by getting involved in this kind of struggle to make this world a better world? What can you suggest to them?
Well, I think many of the things Mandela stood for are very impressive. He believed in a non-racial democracy. I think this is a good goal as a long-term goal. Even if in the medium term, sometimes people will organize around their culture or ethnicity. In the long run, I think non-racialism is the right goal. His attitude towards political struggle, he was very flexible in his mindset. At the beginning, he supported non-violent struggle, then he switched towards an armed struggle, and then he came back to non-violent struggle. He was always open to questioning his tactics. I think these were great things. I think also, maybe perhaps the greatest thing of Mandela is the example of the person. One of the most challenging things, and as a professor, we're always working with students who come, and I work with students here in Toronto. I teach at George Brown College as well, and I work with a lot of students who come from very difficult backgrounds. And you can see how the frustrations and difficulties and obstacles they face can discourage them. What Mandela shows us is that the most important thing for any human being is to learn to discipline your anger, not to let frustration cloud your mind, but to discipline your anger and plan, think long term, you know, allow your foresight full capacity. Don't be limited by the circumstances around you. And I think that is I think the most important thing I get from Mandela personally is learning self-mastery. The most interesting period, I think, in Mandela's life, at least for myself or the person studying Mandela, when you read his autobiography, is reading about his time on Robben Island. And you really see this process of being on this island for 18 years and learning to master his circumstances and inspire the men around him and be inspired by them. I think that's very important and very, very impressive from Mandela, and something we should all learn from.
You mentioned it's an interesting analysis you made in relation to Venezuela and comparing it with South Africa. Now, the African societies and South Africa in particular is facing some of the major challenges of access to land. The ownership patterns in terms of economic power hasn't been really altered really with the arrival of the ANC to power. How would you see the future of South Africa in the decades to come? The post-Mandela South Africa?
Well, you'll remember in The Wretched of the Earth, Frantz Fanon's great anti-colonial text, he points out that when a liberation movement enters power, it begins to replicate the oppression of the previous movement. And so, of course, you then need the formation of a new liberation movement. And in the case of South Africa, you can see, there needs to now be new movements that are going to push for transformations in terms of poverty, unemployment, inequality. So maybe a new agenda with new activists and a new youthful leadership. Right now, I think maybe one of the worst impacts of the ANC now is the leadership. We can see it appears to be an exhausted leadership. They need young new leaders. And leaders who are going to be focused around this question of poverty, especially the economic problems. Mandela was fantastic in many ways in terms of solving certain political problems, but now we need solutions to economic problems.
I would like to thank you very much for your great contribution today, and I'm sure we will have a chance to have more collaboration in the future. Thanks for being with us today.
Thank you. Take care.
That was my special guest, Thomas Ponaya, who is a PhD and professor of social science, social studies, and who teaches at George Brown College right here in Toronto. And we were discussing the legacy of Nelson Mandela and also the way forward for South Africa.